Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly.
Downtime Upload.
Podcast.
And that third voice was?
Sebastian Clovis Skelton.
And Seb's one of the reporters on Computer Weekly. And also here today we have Bill Goodman. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Our investigations editor. And the reason why we've got the two guys back on the podcast is to discuss their rich vein of Facebook stories. They've been shortlisted in the technology category for the Press Gazette British Journalism Awards on Tuesday the 10th of December at the Hilton Bankside, alongside Duncan Campbell.
Indeed.
Bill, could you say a few words about Duncan? Because there are two Duncan Campbells. It's very confusing.
It's incredibly confusing.
But and they're both Scottish.
They're both Scottish, which is even more confusing. And they both accidentally receive each other's mail. And they both know each other. So we only worked with one Duncan Campbell. So this was Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist, who, as opposed to Duncan Campbell, the Guardian crime reporter. You know, we had a choice of two, and we chose
I hope the right one turns up on the night and tries to claim the other one's glory, in case you
were... he is going to turn up to the awards,
which is great.
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth pausing to say this is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And our lads are up against the Financial Times twice, the BBC, ITV and The Guardian. And it's a very starry awards programme in general, is it not? So why have they been nominated? They've been nominated for these Facebook stories. And we're going to discuss the second tranche of those. We had them on the podcast at the end of July. Can you believe it was the end of July?
Yeah, it doesn't seem that long ago.
That was episode 26, listeners, if you want to go back and check that out. Top line on the rest of the podcast today. In our regular Tech on the Stump feature, Seb, I'm going to ask you to say a few words about the SNP manifesto, because we dealt with the Liberal Democrat manifesto in the last podcast.
And we dug a little bit more into Labour's tech policies and the Conservative ones, didn't we, last week?
Yeah.
But yeah, there was no word from the SNP at the time.
Yeah, a wee bit on those. And also we discussed Labour's free broadband offer on another podcast as well. So Seb will just say a few things about that. Caroline and I will cover off some other bits and bobs. Caroline, you've brought an IR35 lens to bear on the manifestos.
And at the time that we were coming in here, there's like a bit of breaking news on that. So yeah, I'll try and pick through that as well.
Oh, cool. Breaking news. And then you're off to Vegas.
Mm-hmm. For the AWS reInvent annual conference.
And you're going to give us a little preview of that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm off to Birmingham.
Wow. The Vegas of the Midlands.
Indeed. for the annual SAP UK and Ireland SAP Users Group conference, which is usually quite good fun. Very down to earth, a massive contrast with Dreamforce, where I was in San Francisco. It's like the antithesis of that in a number of ways. First, let's get into the meat of the Facebook topic. Bill, can we start with you? So basically, Facebook has been, over a long period of time, very beastly to its ecosystem. It's invited people to participate in its platform and then done nasty things to them.
Yes. So our stories were based on a cache of 7,000 pages of leaked documents.
A treasure trove
that was sent anonymously to our friend Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist, not the Scottish crime, who shared them with Computer Weekly and our colleagues in America, NBC. And the documents are astonishing insight into what went on at Facebook and how they used third-party developers to really grow Facebook and take over the competition by getting them to build apps on mobile phones.
Yeah.
Facebook was really behind on mobile phones. And then once Facebook had reached a critical mass, it started to impose conditions on the app, third-party app developers, and to cut off their access to data that they had before, and to put pressure on them to, if they wanted to continue to access data, to spend an awful lot of money buying advertising.
That does sound like extortion.
You may say that, but I couldn't possibly comment. House Judiciary Committee in the States on antitrust is looking into precisely this point as well, because Duncan enabled them to receive copies of the documents in a manner that was legally difficult to challenge.
So they've got the treasure trove as well.
Yeah, we published them on Computer Weekly, and simultaneously the documents went to the House Judiciary Committee in the States, which is investigating antitrust in big tech.
And you can get the documents through Computer Weekly. You've got
there's links on Computer Weekly.
Yeah.
Some of them are quite big, so you might need sort of fast Wi-Fi and a bit of computer memory. But yeah, they're all available.
And have you read them all?
We have.
Sebastian's face. I'll get him.
Thank you so much.
We've been through all 7,000 pages.
And so I read quite a bit of your coverage. One of the pieces is how Facebook's switcheroo plan concealed scheme to kill popular apps. So is that essentially what you've been talking about there, the switcheroo? You described it as a switcheroo strategy. So I just wondered.
Switcheroo. This is how they have Facebook refer to it in their internal emails.
I see. Okay.
So it's called switcheroo. And the idea was that they had a big conference called Developers Conference called F8, and Mark Zuckerberg was going to speak at it.
Yeah.
And at the time, they were introducing all of these changes that would deny apps access to data that they could previously get.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan was to make some sort of announcement about this, but the announcement never happened, and that was the switcheroo. So rather than announce something that probably wouldn't go down very well at the big FA conference, they presented the whole idea as a way to improve privacy and improve trust and trust of users.
This is the pivot to privacy? Or does that come later?
That came later, but the actual detail to developers, you're not going to get access to the data that you would previously get,
mm-hmm.
wasn't discussed at the conference at all. And it was just mentioned in a line at the end of a blog. So you really had to look carefully to see it.
And this was around about 2015?
14, I think, for that particular FA conference.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a switcheroo plan. Rather than have the announcement about you're no longer going to get data, it was switched around.
Yeah, but on top of that, I'd say it's worth adding that I think in that developer's blog post you mentioned, they do talk about which APIs they would shut off, and that is how the developers access the data in the ecosystem.
Mm.
But they claimed that these were some of the least used or least important APIs to developers, when in fact they were actually the most used, and a lot of companies relied on these APIs to get that data that they had built these businesses on.
Yeah, I mean, what the thing that struck me is, you know, Facebook was absolutely paranoid about third-party apps becoming competitive with Facebook turning into social media networks that could rival Facebook. So there's a lot of talk from Mark Zuckerberg about trying to get people off at WhatsApp and onto Messenger. And they were monitoring how well WhatsApp was doing and how well other apps and messaging services were doing, using a VPN service that they'd supply to people with mobile phones, and the VPN service was surreptitiously gathering data on the performance of WhatsApp.
I mean, I think it's also good to note at this point that from the documents, and how, you know, people at Facebook talk to each other internally, there's the definite culture of fear, and there is a paranoia about competition, which is really quite interesting. Mm. When, you know, I think the image of Facebook is this kind of supremely confident behemoth that can kind of go around, do whatever it wants, and it knows exactly what it's doing all the time. But internally, I don't think it's as kind of clear cut as that. I think it's quite chaotic, and there's a lot of paranoia over there about competition and people kind of taking over from Facebook, which is quite, you know, kind of goes against all the common knowledge that you have about the company.
Yeah, so they're quite reactive.
Mm.
Obviously, Facebook owns WhatsApp now. And it's just the question that came into my head as Bill was talking us through all that is, so obviously when they were tracking users and all sort of the activities of WhatsApp so closely, could that have jeopardised that acquisition? Because it's not really done on fair ground, is it? If they had such insight into how it works and stuff like that. Is that something that's ever...
Well, it didn't come out at the time of the acquisition. So this was going on behind the scenes. Yeah. It wasn't public knowledge. Yeah. So,
but could that be something that retrospectively could call into question? I know it's
a really good question.
Yeah, because you know they've got this insider knowledge, and would that have that they shouldn't
have? It'd be really interesting to see where that goes, because it's not. If you look through the Facebook's like SEC with the SEC filings, so the Securities and Exchange Commission in America, pretty much every year. It's since about 2015-16, whenever they bought WhatsApp, they talk about the acquisition.
Mm.
They obviously don't mention any of the tracking stuff. Yeah. So those are official filings to the SEC. So I imagine there would be some kind of scope for like retrospectively or retroactively kind of looking at that for regulators.
So in the US, the Federal Trade Commission is carrying out an antitrust investigation, and it's looking at this issue, whether some of the acquisitions should be unwound, whether Facebook should be broken up. There's another investigation by attorneys general of the states. I think about 37, 47 attorney generals are looking into Facebook and antitrust issues. It comes down to US law, because Facebook is a free service, so How do you regulate under US law a free service?
Mm.
Well, it's very difficult. So regulators are now looking at privacy as a grounds for antitrust actions, which is a new interpretation of the law.
Mm.
Seb, I know we've talked fleetingly about Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which kind of provides some of the kind of big picture to this.
Yeah.
I mean, she basically argues that Facebook et al., so Google as well, some of the others, constitute a kind of rogue element in capitalism, and that basically, ultimately, they have to be outlawed. And what they do has to be declared illegal, because it's about stealing private experiences and using those to make money, because we are the product as Facebook users. We're not the customers. The customers are companies that buy the data and so on. I just wondered if you had any kind of reflections on that kind of bigger picture thing about what, you know, should be done in the end. What can we do about the power of Facebook?
I mean, I don't know what should be done or what we can do.
Well, we are journalists, so we have...
I mean, I...
license to speculate.
Personally, I think that whatever should be done to limit their power should be done. And it should be done, you know, quite drastic measures should probably be taken. Because like you said, I think the exact phrase she uses, it's a rogue mutation of capitalism. And I think a big part of her point is that we now live in a world where this kind of digital surveillance is a given, and her base argument at the end of all of that is that we can have all this digital technology without the surveillance part of it. The surveillance part of it is just to kind of keep the business models of these huge tech companies going. No need for it whatsoever. We can still have the social utility of platforms like Facebook and Google without the constant surveillance.
And we can assert our democratic values against these companies.
Yeah, I mean, that's our argument pretty much. And Roger McNamee, who was actually who was an early investor in Facebook and one of Zuckerberg's kind of mentors, actually ended up bringing Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer, into the company at quite an early stage. And I was in Vegas in October. He was basically saying all the same kind of stuff as that, the surveillance aspect of this and the basically out of control data collection is all completely unnecessary. It's basically there to fund the business models rather than, you know, provide any actual value to society.
But I think, and that is why, going back to your earlier point, you know, there needs to be kind of a drastic response to this and sort of tighter regulation. The recurring thing we hear all the time is that the digital world moves so much quicker than the legislative landscape and stuff like that. So it's almost like, well, have they done all these things because they knew they could get away with it? And how do you stop another Facebook out there somewhere just thinking, well, we employ all this because there's no rules or laws saying we're not allowed to do it? So it's almost like you need to sort of send a message, as it were, that, you know, they got away with it before because the laws weren't there, but now we need to sort of draw a line and make sure other companies aren't doing the same.
It's worrying time for Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg has been vigorously lobbying in Washington, meeting with senators and had lunch or breakfast with President Trump at least twice. So they're clearly worried. There are multiple investigations going on across the world. So a lot of lobbying going on. It's a bit like Microsoft, 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Microsoft was up to all sorts of anti-competitive types of behaviour, but got fined by the US and by the European Union.
Yeah.
Turned itself around, and Bill Gates became a philanthropist and restored his image after that. And, you know, can Mark Zuckerberg do the same? Well, maybe, maybe not. It may be too late. I don't know.
It's a very different proposition, though, as well, isn't it? Like, if you think of Microsoft, in terms of turning around the public perception, whether or not that would have harmed sales, people were locked into sort of multi-year contracts with Microsoft products. So it's kind of like, we can't just switch off their technology. Whereas Facebook, it's a lot more flippant. You can just say, right, I don't want to be here anymore, and like shut down your account, or just move on to, or just stop posting there and then move on to another social network.
I'm not sure that's easy, because what social network would you join? And we know all your friends are on Facebook and they send you messages on Facebook.
Or WhatsApp, actually. That's the thing, it's increasingly WhatsApp, but Facebook owned, so.
And Instagram, they're on
there. Instagram. Twitter is different, it's a different type of service, and LinkedIn. It's more professional career and networking. So really, what is the alternative to Facebook?
But again, Shoshana Zuboff, the author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, one of the things that she says is that we just have to change public opinion, and that is starting to happen, and that once people do understand what's going on, they are up for opting out of Facebook or whatever. They do want things to happen. But that change of public opinion, there's all sorts of little signs of that, including there's a video this week, Caroline, yep. Sacha Baron Cohen, Ali G. Well, actually, not Ali G, but the...
He played the character.
Yeah, it's out of character.
Yeah.
For one of the very few times, I believe.
Yeah, me and Seb were talking about this before we came in here, how sort of disconcerting it is to see him as a normal person, not a normal person, but not playing a character. And I think that's probably why he's been so effective over the years, is that you just never see him out of costume. So it's kind of, you could walk past him on the street and be like, oh, he's that guy. Very tall. But yeah, it was a video earlier this week. He was talking the Anti-Defamation League Summit on Anti-Semitism in New York. And that was this time last week. But the video sort of got picked up quite a bit the video of his speech got picked up quite a lot over the weekend. And there was sort of a few sections that have been edited and flagged, where he is sort of talking about the problems of basically Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and Google, which he describes as the greatest propaganda machine in history, because they allow sort of hateful views and fake news and stuff like that to be amplified across the globe, and also to be targeted specifically at sort of certain users who might be susceptible to falling for what's being said, basically.
And it calls for a fundamental rethink on social media,
mm-hmm.
which is the kind of thing that Zuboff, etc., are talking about in terms of, I'm not attributing this to him, but that idea of it's a rogue company, and it has to be, at some point, it has to be outlawed. And once you've got public opinion behind that kind of proposition, then you get the legislation after that. That's the kind of the pathway, as it were.
Mm.
One thing that struck me about the documents is how much of a strategist Mark Zuckerberg is. And Caroline, you were mentioning, you know, people are communicating now using WhatsApp as a mm-hmm. social media type application. But this was actually the strategy way back in 2013-2014. So Zuckerberg set out this quite prescient vision of messaging taking over from Facebook and other forms of social media as the main way people interact.
That's interesting. I mean, he's clearly a very, very clever guy.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, we know this from the film where he talks about his SAT scores. Amazing.
But I think that does hold true in that on Facebook there's this feature where it's the Facebook memories, where you can look back at posts that you've done over however many years on that, like on a specific day. And some of the stuff, like you look back at like what you were posting 11 years ago, I'm not saying anything that I was posting, but it's a lot more involved and like kind of personal kind of stuff like that. And then as it goes on, those posts become fewer and fewer because you are kind of more aware of like everything you get said will be in a sort of semi-public domain. So a lot of it does retreat into sort of private WhatsApp groups or Messenger groups and stuff like that. So it's almost like a reaction to being too public in the early days on social media to retreating a bit.
Mm. But even with the retreat, though, I don't think that, you know, on Messenger, Facebook still knows everything that's going in those messages and that. So even if people feel more private, they don't really have that extra privacy.
Yeah.
Well, part of Mark Zuckerberg's plan in 2013 was to monetize Messenger and WhatsApp. This was even before he bought WhatsApp.
Mm.
So gradually, the idea is that to gradually get people used to receiving messages from businesses,
mm.
having businesses interact with them. So eventually, you sort of get messages in your inbox from people trying to sell you stuff in quite subtle ways. But it wasn't something that could be done overnight, so there was this long strategy to get people to a point where they would accept that. That was planned back in 2013.
Mm.
By having a tab where you could look at, you know, paid-for posts or other interesting things without it actually going into your Messenger box, just to get people used to the idea that there was advertising and commercial services on Messenger. And the whole idea was to get, again, third-party developers to build intelligent bots that could answer questions automatically. And they've built a whole network of tens of thousands of bots that can answer your questions. And again, Facebook would build a super bot on top of this using the data from the bots that businesses have already built. It's the same strategy over again.
Is that where that company called, was it Onavo, is it an Israeli tech intelligence firm, were they involved in that? Or were they employed for a different purpose?
Onavo was used for a different purpose.
Right.
Onavo was a VPN app.
Oh, that was the VPN app. Yeah. So that was the WhatsApp identification.
Yeah, it was a VPN app. Lots of people downloaded this VPN app to improve their privacy and security while they were browsing the internet, unaware that Facebook was actually monitoring the data and recording which apps people were using and for how long and for what purposes. So Facebook had complete intelligence of all their rivals and how well they were doing and what was popular. And the internal charts in the Facebook documents show quite clearly that WhatsApp is way ahead of Facebook Messenger, and there's a lot of worry and internal discussion about this.
And it's not just WhatsApp and like big companies. They were like, if you look in the documents, there's entire documents that are just pages and pages of spreadsheets with, you know, the Anavo data that Facebook holds on these companies.
Mm.
So it's quite far reaching. Even though it was obviously used for this very big acquisition, it was a really quite far reaching program.
They had terms of what it was tracking. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And they have this thing called acqui-hire, where they hire through acquiring.
Well, that was it's quite common in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
You know, you hire good people by buying their startup companies.
Yes.
But it can also be used for eliminating competition. So if there's a startup that's a bit of a competitor, you can buy them out. And there were certainly incidents where Facebook looked at buying competitors. In some cases, they didn't, but you know, companies they were worried about, they would often buy. So neutralise competition that way. There's one incident, there's a company called iLike, and that was a music company, and it was run by a guy called Ali Petrovi, who's quite well known in Silicon Valley, and you know, he's a friend of Facebook, and Facebook offered to buy his company, and he says in a sworn deposition that he was told, well, we can buy you really cheap. And he said, why? Well, because we can just turn your access to data off, so we don't have to pay a lot of money for you. So there was that sort of pressure going.
We're going to cut off your oxygen supply. Yeah.
You know, and that's not a unique experience. Of course, I mean, the other thing that Facebook did was copy the good ideas that developers came up with. So iLike's music pages became part of Facebook, for example. And they copied ideas from the Facebook wall, famous Facebook wall. Originally it was just text only, and there were people who developed apps to include video and graphics, and they were incorporated into the Facebook main product. So a lot of app developers went out of business that way too.
I can remember that happening, because it used to look a lot sort of tattier and messy, the Facebook sort of interface, because you'd have all these third party kind of plugins and things like that there. Like, you know, if you wanted to show off that you liked a particular band, that would have been iLike and stuff like that. And yeah, over time that's all just become blue and white, and
I think that was
merged into it.
That was probably part of the tactic, though, I think, because obviously if you're inviting all of these app developers, an entire ecosystem, to come and build things on top of your platform, and at the same time you have a policy about your own kind of quote-unquote core functionality. So basically what would happen is these app developers would build these functionalities, Facebook would look at them and be like, oh, okay, we'll build one. Now it's Facebook's core functionality.
Mm.
You can't do that anymore because, you know, you're replicating our functionality.
Yeah.
You've got to shut it down. So they would basically just, and it happened with Instagram as well. That's in the documents.
Mm.
There was a video editing app called Photo with like three H's. but then Instagram made Boomerang, which is basically a copy of that. So I think a big part of it as well was invite all this talent from the ecosystem to build on the platform, replicate what they built, and then say that they're replicating Facebook to get rid of them.
And you've already got all this data and that. Like, what are these features that users make the most of?
Facebook's scale as well. Like, what are people going to turn to? Will they turn to the Facebook version of it, or the, well, it wouldn't be an quote-unquote off-brand version because it came first, but that would, I think that's how Facebook users kind of see it. So you're just kind of completely undermining the companies you've just invited to come and build a business on your platform as well.
Is there anything in the documents at all about WeChat?
There is rather a lot about WeChat. WeChat is a Chinese messaging service.
And there's a lot more besides. It's how you pay for things in China.
So, Facebook were very worried about WeChat, and it was regarded as a competition. I think they banned WeChat from advertising on Facebook, and they banned a lot of other messaging type services from advertising on Facebook because they didn't want people downloading their apps. And Zuckerberg was very cognizant of WeChat, and when he was developing a strategy for messaging, private messaging back in 2013, a lot of the ideas from WeChat were incorporated into that strategy, and he's quite open about that.
I bet when they look at Chinese surveillance capitalism in the form of WeChat, backed up by one of the most authoritarian states in human history, they must be quite envious.
Yeah, I imagine they probably are, to be honest. But I think that also builds back onto the point about just the sheer paranoia as well that existed at Facebook, because obviously they're very happy to work with people who are quote-unquote competitors in some instances, mainly if they're being paid a lot of money for mobile ads. But even with companies that can provide Facebook with these, you know, huge advertising spends they want, Facebook don't want it if that company is competitive with them, like WeChat, or there's, you know, the other messaging apps, Line, I think, and Kakao as well. So it shows the paranoia as well, I think, in the sense that they're getting all these money off people who are competitors, but other ones that they're too afraid of, they don't even want the money from, they just want them gone and not being able to do anything on the platform too. I don't know if you noticed in the documents, Bill, but it definitely seemed like, yeah, there was just people that didn't know what was going on a lot of the time. Changes would be made and other people would be asking what's happening here. But I don't think that was part of the Zuckerberg plan, even if it kind of was chaotic further down the organisation.
Well, I think some people within Facebook were deliberately not told of what the master plan was. So there was a master plan that was known by Mark Zuckerberg and some of the very senior people at Facebook. But other people who were quite serious were just not told about things, and it was partly a way of, you know, restricting information, making sure strategies didn't leak out, making sure competitors were not warned. I think there's one occasion where people were told they were not allowed to give out their emails to developers in case they had developers contacting them and asking questions. And it's clear some very senior people in Facebook didn't know what was going on. There are discussions in the documents between people trying to work out why Facebook was cutting off data, API access to developers. People saying, yeah, it sounds like developers would hate us, they're just ratcheting down the openness of the platform. Yeah, this document is so schizo. Our philosophy is data should only be shared with an app when the user wants to share it. You mean our philosophy of right now, not for the past 7 years when it was different. So these are the sort of comments we're getting from people who hadn't been told what the real strategy was. I mean, the real strategy was to put pressure on developers to persuade them to buy advertising. Mm. That's how Facebook made its money. So you don't have access to our data anymore. Oh, but if you buy some advertising, maybe we can give you access to our data again. And that was the whole point of it.
So yeah, it does sound like a great place to work.
So you've published 7,000 on News Weekly. And I was just keen to know, is the hope that then other people will go away and do reporting on them as well? Or is it just so that just all the information's out there, transparency, and anyone can just find out what's going on?
Yeah, there has been quite a bit of reporting. When the documents were published, there was a lot of coverage at the time. But in the way of news, it's died off now, so I think they're there more for regulators and academics to examine and
go through. It's a public good?
There's a public interest in the documents being made public. So, and indeed, regulators, we know, are looking at them.
We've touched on, as we said earlier, the main national parties, UK-wide parties, but the SNP released their manifesto this week. Anything techie in that?
So I've basically been going through all the party manifestos, looking at their technology policies, digital plans. And I guess at the time of the last podcast, the SNP hadn't released theirs yet, but it came out this week. A bit lighter on tech policies than the others, which were fairly light, I suppose.
Yeah, we always struggle.
Nice and quicker to write up than the others anyway. Not complaining about. So the main thing, I guess, is kind of, I would say, is kind of in line with a lot of the other manifestos, is just the environmental policies being very much at the top. So for the SNP, one of the big things they're proposing is a quote-unquote green energy deal, which will ensure that green energy schemes get the long-term certainty they need to kind of support investment. So I think, I mean, they're kind of vague about it, but the energy deal is essentially something that will allow them to invest in lots of different kind of areas of green technology. That was kind of my takeaway from it. So for example, they specifically said about wave and tidal energy and developing an industrial strategy for how that can kind of be implemented across Scotland. And then outside of that, there's the net zero fund. Yeah, the net zero fund, which I think is part of that, and is basically a fund to support kind of low emission technologies. But yeah, there's a lot in the manifesto about electric vehicles, and they've actually set quite an ambitious target of having all vehicles electric by 2032, which I think off the top of my head is before any of the other political parties. So a lot of the investment from this green energy deal will go into funding that. All they're really going to do is finish the rollout of broadband, like every other political party. The difference for them is that they're very focused, the SNP, on online harms. So they actually want an online regulator with kind of statutory powers to take action against companies that aren't kind of protecting their users, I guess. So those are kind of, I guess, the top parts of it. But there's a lot that's kind of missing that's mentioned in a lot of the other manifestos as well. So there's nothing really on education or skills that much. There's a little bit. They've got this thing called the Climate Emergency Skills Action Plan, which will promote a fair and inclusive jobs market by basically helping upskill people. But that's all the education they mention in terms of technology. There's nothing about police or security services. So it's kind of light compared to the other manifestos.
That's kind of outside their power in a way, because they're obviously running Scotland.
A lot of what they commit to doing is pressing the UK government to do stuff technology-wise.
Although they are the third biggest party in House of Commons, and that's probably going to be the case.
Yeah. I think it definitely will be. I mean, I've given up trying to predict elections after the last few years, but I imagine they will kind of retain that position. There.
Did they have anything to say about IR35 and all that?
Yep, they have said that they are going to embark on a review of the IR35 reforms being extended to the private sector. So that has been warmly welcomed by contractors, but there's been a little bit of controversy before I came in here today to do the recording. So we wrote a story yesterday saying that the SNP, Lib Dems and Labour have all said that they are going to sort of look into IR35, like whether or not the reform should be extended to the private sector, and that has, which is still the case, that has put maybe a bit more pressure on the Conservative Party to sort of say whether or not they, you know, if they're elected again, will they do something similar? Because at the moment, they're sort of one of the only parties that hasn't said. The shadow business secretary of the Labour Party was at an event this week organised by IPSI, and he sort of said on stage that, you know, we're going to, the end point of it was that people came away from that event with the impression that they were going to scrap the reforms, extending the reforms to the private sector. And then one of the senior policy people from IPSI sort of contacted him on Twitter and said, oh, can we just clarify this is actual policy? You're going to, you know, that's what's going to happen. And he's like, yeah, absolutely. That's what his tweet said. And now he's deleted the tweet. And yeah, so no one's really sure. So we went to the Labour Party press people this morning just to clarify. And they gave us some stuff on background, which we're not allowed to publish. But yeah, so we're not really sure sort of what's happened here. Has he sort of overspoken, if you know what I mean, maybe over-edged what they're doing? Or, you know, are they one of these parties that is going to do a review? He said they would halt the Conservative Party's policy on IR35, which people thought meant scrapping it. Mm-hmm. So is he misspoken in some ways? Are they just going to do a review of the policy? And he's sort of intimated that they're going to get rid of it altogether. So there's a little bit of confusion. I'm hoping when I get out of here, I'll check my emails and I've got like the requests for comment I've asked various people for, just to bring a bit of clarity to
so
that.
So the story continues.
Yeah, as it always does with this IR35 stuff.
So from a grim election Britain to sunny Las Vegas.
Yeah.
looking forward to, what do they call it? Reinvent.
Yeah, reinvent. There's, as there always is with tech firms, there's like random capitalization and lowercase letters
in
there.
It's quite confusing.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Isn't it?
And whatever way I write it, our sub-editors always correct
it.
it's the big one for me. It's the biggest cloud conference I attend throughout the year. And I think this is going to be my seventh one. And I went to the very first one, and that was just, it has changed so much in terms of scale in that time. So the first one I ever went to, it was in one hotel in Las Vegas, the Venetian. And you could just kind of rattle around it, really, between sessions. There's no hassle getting anywhere. There were just like piles of developers like littering all the corridors, crouched over with very bad posture over their laptops doing work and things like that. And year on year it's just got bigger and bigger, and now you still see all the developers, but you also see lots of people in suits sort of mingling amongst them all. And now I think last year it was spread over 5 hotels just to accommodate
five hotels
on the Vegas Strip, just to make sure everyone can see the keynote. Wow. So it's streamed to different hotels, stuff like that, sessions everywhere. So yeah, the first year I went, there was a session by Netflix. This was in 2012, I think, and I didn't pre-register for a seat or anything. I just walked straight in. Whereas now there will be queues around the whole of the Venetian casino, people trying to get into like things like that. So if you haven't reserved a seat, you're pretty much not going to get into anything. It's everything has to be planned.
Don't they have reserved seating for press? Follow those people with the old lollipops.
Sometimes, but then also I think they are very much like, well, we want the people who use the technology to get first dibs on stuff like that.
Radical.
Yeah, so you can't, like, they do say to you, like, reserve your seat and you'll get a seat in there, but if you haven't reserved anything, if I turned up now saying, don't you know who I am, they'd be like, yeah, we don't care. So, which is pretty much the case where I go anyway. Yeah, so I don't have any predictions on what they're going to announce, but now every year there's just something completely left field. You know, I kind of predicted that they were going to announce this. So last year they had on the day before the conference started, they ushered all the journalists into a press conference room, and Andy Jassy, the AWS CEO, got on stage and had this long preamble about how, like, the difficulties of having sort of satellites circling the earth, and they're collecting all this data, but it takes so long to get it down, like, from the satellites down to the earth. I was just sitting there, I was like, oh my god, they're going to put a data centre on the moon or something like that. He was like, it's going to be data centres in space, it's going to be amazing. And it wasn't anything of the sort, but it ended up being this thing, AWS ground stations, space antennas on the ground, ground stations that get the data, they process it on the fly there and then store it all at these places so the data can go back and forth really quickly. But I was like, I would never in a million years have predicted that would have been the flagship announcement.
So while you're off to Vegas, I'm travelling up to Birmingham.
Lucky.
The SAP UK and Ireland, mustn't forget Ireland, user group, which is usually a very down-to-earth event, as I was saying, like the opposite of Dreamforce. Just lots of users who manage SAP systems, HR professionals, IT professionals, people in charge of kind of business intelligence initiatives as well, because of SAP's BI software that they acquired many years ago with Business Objects. Usually one of the predictable features of the user group, and this is something like my seventh as well, is whatever the latest thing that SAP has been punting at their Sapphire user conference in the summer, whatever that is, it might be C4HANA, it might be, which is their kind of customer version or customer complement to S4HANA, which is their ERP system on HANA database steroids, or whether it's Leonardo, SAP Leonardo, which is the way that they basically market all their cool stuff, so all the Internet of Things stuff, the machine learning stuff, the kind of cutting edge digital transformation stuff, SAP Leonardo, named after Leonardo DiCaprio, of course. Whatever it is, it's not.
Oh, okay. Wow, I didn't know that.
Whatever it is.
And that's the Wikipedia page for.
Whatever it is, users won't have heard of it. It'll be, so I'll get a basic story saying a quarter of SAP users have heard of whatever the cutting edge
thing
is.
Leonardo DiCaprio, yeah.
That, yeah, exactly. So I can look forward to that. And the Christmas market is always quite good.
Oh.
Quite good value. I think that's all we've got time for this week. We've been blathering for quite some time.
Yeah.
The next podcast will be on the eve of the awards, so good luck, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And we'll all be there as well.
Yeah.
Drinking.
Yeah.
That's being very sensible.
Yeah. Drinking responsibly.
So I'll just say thank you very much indeed to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Thank you to Bill.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Seb.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon. Bye.